I direct your attention today to 1 Samuel 18 and 1 Samuel 20 as we look at the theme, the building blocks of friendship. I want to read, first of all, from 1 Samuel 18, verses 1 through 4, a time in Jonathan and David's relationship prior to the enmity that developed in Saul's heart toward David. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Then turning to 1 Samuel 20. The verses that follow here come after a time where on seven occasions Saul has sought to take David's life. So there is a reaffirmation of the friendship under these new conditions. Then David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to take my life?" "Never," Jonathan replied, "you are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." But David took an oath and said, "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, 'Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, there is only a step between me and death.'" Thereupon there follows a conversation in which Jonathan agrees with David that he will sound out his father at the monthly civil and religious festival of the new moon, and when David doesn't show up for the banquet and Saul asks where he was, he will discern whether Saul's attitude toward David still is hardened, and he will come back and let David know whether it's safe or not for him to return to the king's court. We pick up then their continuing conversation in verse 12. "Then Jonathan said to David, 'By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away safely. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father, but show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth.' So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, 'May the Lord call David's enemies to account.' And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as himself." Well, 2 days later, Jonathan shows up with his arrow bearer, and there's a signal that's been arranged that if he tells the arrow bearer, "I have shot the arrows beyond such and such a stone over there," it means David is in jeopardy of his life. He must flee. If he says, "The arrows fell on this side," then David is safe. David hides behind the stone. And by the way, that's a poignant phrase. And next week we're going to talk about what to do when life's circumstances get out of control and you're waiting for somebody else to make a decision and it's out of your hands. What do you do? Jonathan shows up, shoots the arrows beyond the stone. The arrow bearer leaves to go back home, and there is this final conversation in the last verses of chapter 20, verse 41. "After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan 3 times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, 'Go in shalom, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, The Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.' Then David left, and Jonathan went back to town." We have before us the story of one of the world's great friendships, one of the great friendships of the Bible, the friendship of Jonathan and David. The beginning of their friendship is noted in the verses we have read today from chapter 18. "Jonathan became one in spirit with David." The King James says that Jonathan's soul became knitted to David's, and he loved him as himself. Unfortunately, in our society today, this text has been seized by some homosexuals to assert that this infers a homosexual relationship between Jonathan and David. The perversion of this text simply shows how true is the thesis that is in David Smith's book, The Friendless American Male, that American men don't dare show friendship toward one another lest they be suspect or misunderstood, that we are, as men in this society, largely friendless. Probably less so in the Christian community, but certainly there's an aspect of it that's true for us as Christian men as well. And I want to pause for just a moment at the beginning of this service and just talk to the men that are in the crowd and talk about the fact that it is true that we often do not have the friends the women have. Women seem to have their own network of camaraderie and friendship. Men find it more difficult to establish friendships. Why is this so? David Smith says there are really six reasons. One is that men have an aversion to showing emotion. We are taught, for example, big boys don't cry. And yet emotion is a very vital part of friendship. David had it here. He wept much. But we are told, don't show emotion. When Pat Schroeder pulled out of the presidential race as a congresswoman from Colorado, on that occasion of the press conference, when she withdrew her name or said she wasn't going to run, she cried. She was vilified in the press for that. We don't want somebody negotiating with Gorbachev who breaks down and cries. What standard were we holding her to? We were saying, Patricia Schroeder, you're getting ready to enter a man's world, the world of running for president. And if you're going to run for president, then you have to act like a man. And men don't cry. It's a subtle message involved there. She cried for herself when President Reagan welcomed home the caskets of the men that were killed in the Stark in the Persian Gulf. He also wept. He was not as severely criticized for that as was Pat Schroeder, but then the rationale was he wasn't weeping for himself, he was weeping for another. That may be permitted. I'll tell you one thing, if I had spent all my life trying to run for president and had to finally withdraw, I'd feel a little bit crushed by that, wouldn't you? I think I could be excused for wanting to shed a tear. But men don't show emotion. And second, we men have an inability often to have fellowship. And the reason is that we find it safer to talk about a lot of external things. How's your job? How's your investments? What's your golf score? What's the stock market doing? All those kinds of things. Rather than talking about the stuff that makes friendship, which is talking about what's going on inside our lives. And third, we men often don't have friends because we have inadequate role models. We have this myth of the macho American male that somehow we're not man if we're not in the mold of a John Wayne. And I respect John Wayne, and that's no denigration on his life. By the way, I met John Wayne about a year before he died. He was best man in a wedding ceremony I performed. I wish everyone would have had the chance of meeting him when he was in those last months of his illness, because you could immediately have empathy for the man. You don't have empathy for John Wayne, the shoot-em-up cowboy who solves all the problems of life by strength and force, but you can identify and have empathy with a person who is suffering. But we've adopted models like Arnold Schwarzenegger and people like this, and guys who are indoors and are bald-headed are, like me, are wimps, you know. I've always had little trouble with those role models in accepting my own maleness at times. Well, am I really a man, or am I just, you know, a wimp? Men also have trouble with friendships because we're inordinately competitive. I mean, even in playing golf with my friends, I'm not out just to have a good time. I'm out to win. And then we have an inability to ask for help often. Why is it that in marriages that are troubled, 9 out of every 10 times, it'll be the wife that volunteers to make an appointment with a counselor? And the husband has to be dragged, if at all, if he goes at all, kicking and screaming, because we men don't feel that we have to talk to anybody about our problems. I mean, if we can't handle this ourselves, we're sure not going to have lay our life out before anybody else. We have an inability to ask for help often. And six, we don't have friends often because of incorrect priorities. Our priorities are making a living, financial security, getting ahead, being number one, career goals. And our priorities may not lie in the building of our relationships until maybe we get older and it becomes maybe a bit late. Ralph Waldo Emerson has an eloquent statement in his remark, "We take care of our health, we lay up money, we make our roof tight, and our clothing sufficient. But who provides wisely that he shall not be wanting in the best property of all? Friends. Howard Hughes is a classic example of a man whose priorities were goofed up. He had unlimited money, hundreds of aides, countless beautiful women available to him, but he was unloved, and he chose it that way. He said, quote, "Every man has his price, or a guy like me couldn't exist," close quote. And he lived that way. He never learned to love people. He was too busy manipulating them. His interests were in money, technology, gadgets, airplanes, whatever, not in people. Those priorities excluded an emphasis upon relationships, so he died a lonely, eccentric old man, unloved, because he was unloving. In our society, it's easier often to know more about computers than about caring, and it's easier to try to keep up with the Joneses than to keep up with Jesus. We have to be careful about our priorities. I like a little poem that talks about the brevity of life, and we've only got so many years to work out these priorities. Virginia Brazier writes this: "This is the age of the half-read page, and the quick hash, and the mad dash. The bright night with the nerves tight, the plane hop with a brief stop, the lamp tan in a short span, the big shot in a good spot, and the brain strain and the heart pain, and the cat naps till the spring snaps, and the fun's done." Friendships. Some are loners. Some choose to live with a lot of anger and enmity, like Saul. Some people are friendly but have no real deep friends. There's a difference between friendliness and having a deep friend. Friendliness is simply a general surface approach to everyone. But a friendship requires far more depth of interaction and relationship. I would suggest to you that in this message today, we look at these areas of friendship. First of all, building friendships with those who are not our blood relatives. Maybe you have a friend and you need to think about what it is that makes that friendship the way it is and how it can be made better. This message will help do that. Secondly, we also need to turn our blood relationships into friendships. It is the husband-wife relationship, the parent-child relationship, the brother-sister relationship, which ought not to be only one of family or blood. But those family relationships need to be invested or infused with friendship in order to really be successful relationships. And then we also ought to examine what are the factors that make for a great friendship with God. We want to do all that within the context of looking at the building blocks of friendship. There are seven of them that are witnessed in the relationship of Jonathan to David. Look at them with me. Here's what makes good friendship, whether it's friendship within blood relations, friendship with family, or friendship with God, or friendship with friends, friendship with family, friendship with God. First, companionship supersedes control or competition. Companionship supersedes control or competition. That means being with you is more important than running your life or dominating you. Companionship is more important than trying to prove who's better, competing. If anybody ever had a rationale or a reason for competing, it was Jonathan and David. I mean, it's a natural competition situation. Jonathan is crown prince. That means he's next in line to the throne. David is the newly anointed king. Right away, they could be at one another for power, jockeying for who's going to be number one. Not only that, they were prodigious men of valor. They both had exploits on the battlefield that would have decorated them with the Israeli Medal of Honor. They therefore fell in a line of having similar interests because they had similar abilities. They could have been competitors. It's often the case where people compete that they are domineering, and domineering people do not have friends. Show me a domineering person, I will show you a person who does not have friends. They may be friendly, but they do not have friends. Domineering parents, for example, will not have close relationships with their children. That doesn't mean that in our parent-child relationships we throw out this whole idea of authority. But it is to suggest that if we domineer in a harmful way, in an unwholesome way, we are not going to produce friendships with our children. And A domineering spouse can destroy the friendship with a mate. Why is that so? Because to that person, control is more important than companionship. Doing it my way, however, always produces a one-way street of communication rather than reciprocal or two-way communication. The souls, however, of Jonathan and David are knit together like the weaving of a garment. The yarn is going in a little bit by little bit until the tapestry of the whole fabric has been put together. Companionship is based upon mutual respect, compatibility, and shared ideals. Jonathan and David choose companionship, and therefore they are on the road to friendship. Second building block of friendship is that commitment keeps on being renewed in the seasons of life. Friendship requires commitment. In Jonathan and David's case, we might ask, how do you know if you have a good friend or not? And we might be tempted initially to turn to chapter 18, where we begin our reading today, and say, well, here is the obvious evidence that they were good friends. They did something what very few people do at the beginning of a friendship. They make a covenant of friendship. Most of us slide into our friendships, and we wake up one day and we say, oh, I've realized that that now has become a best friend or one of my best friends, and we're not quite exactly sure how that all happened, but it was great it happened. We don't have a formalized ceremony. But David and Jonathan had this little pact, a covenant of friendship between them, and they ratified that covenant by Jonathan giving to David gifts, which show us, by the way, at the time that he was more materially successful than Jonathan, and he wanted to do something, or more materially successful than David, and Jonathan wanted to do something for his friend who didn't have as much as he. Few friendships are marked with such a formal agreement, and yet that exchange does not answer the question, how do you know if you have a good friend? The test of friendship comes when you're in trouble. It comes in adversity. So we turn to chapter 20 and later chapter 23 to see if their friendship was maintained when things got rough for David, when it was inconvenient for Jonathan to be his friend. And we find, sure enough, in those circumstances, they're reaffirming, re-ratifying their covenants. Chapter 20, verse 17. Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him because he loved him as he loved himself. 20:42. We have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord. 23:18. The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. If you read the account of their friendship, you'll see that Jonathan does far more for David during their lifetimes. But that, again, is the nature of friendship. It doesn't require tit for tat, quid pro quo. Simply says, I love you and I will do anything I can for you, even in your downtimes. I'll be true to you. The only shot David really ever has of doing anything for Jonathan is long after Jonathan is dead, and he has a chance to befriend his son Mephibosheth. There, I can't say it. Mephibosheth. It's a tongue twister. Come up later. We'll look at it. Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves at all times. Blood relationships need from time to time the reaffirmation of friendships, the renewal of commitment, so that we do not walk together in family simply out of a sense of contractual duty, but that we walk together as friends, reaffirming our covenants. Friends at times need to reaffirm that to one another. The third building block of friendship is transparency. Transparency or vulnerability must be cultivated if we're going to be true friends. We will never be friends with someone who doesn't let us in to their life, who keeps us at arm's length emotionally. I find transparency and vulnerability in the actions of David in the early part of chapter 20, where he comes to Jonathan and basically he says, Jonathan, I'm scared to death. There's one step between me and death. Here is David, the man of faith and valor who had faced Goliath fearlessly, now saying to his true friend, I am scared. Friendship requires that willingness to be vulnerable. It allows us and requires us to share what's going on in us in the times we don't look so good and we're having trouble with our feelings. We are so often convinced that if people ever saw us as we saw ourselves, the sight would repel them, so we never let them know. we hide within an image, or we retreat within walls of silence, and thereby we build walls when we really need to build windows. Windows are built when we are vulnerable and transparent. The people who are my truest friends are the ones I am the most honest with about myself. I dare to risk and trust my blemishes with them as well as my good points. They really know how I feel about a matter, whereas other people will see the more trained responses to not reflect reaction. But my friends know that I can be totally off the wall at times. Jesus did this, didn't he? If ever anyone had an excuse for not being transparent or vulnerable, he did. I mean, he is the only Son of God. And I would think that if he had the mentality of some, he would have said, since I'm the only Son of God, I must never show people that I am anxious or depressed or am struggling with the will of my Father. I must always keep up the strong front. Let them know I'm Son of God all the way. But in Gethsemane, he gathers his friends to him, his closest friends, and he admits to them, King James English, my soul is girded about with trouble. Which is another way of saying, I feel like the pits. I am deeply depressed. What's that do? It allows us to see Jesus and get close to him. That explains why a person like John could feel comfortable putting his head on Jesus' breast. We're not comfortable with that in our culture, and anybody that does that is immediately suspected of having a misguided sexual orientation. But in Jesus' relationship with John, his vulnerability had cultivated the kind of honesty of expression. He didn't keep him at arm length with, I'm the one who always does the miracles, so stay in awe of me. He also let the disciples see his humanity and the times when he was down. And by the way, seeing that Jesus was down and knowing that he is a man without sin shows us that when you're discouraged and depressed, that is not necessarily always sin. Marion Evans, the English writer who wrote under the pen name George Eliot, says this, "Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh thoughts nor measure words, but to pour them all out just as it is, chaff and grain together, knowing that a faithful friend will take and sift them, keeping what is worth keeping, and then with the breath of kindness blow the chaff away." I like that. Fourth building block of friendship, verbalize your love for your friend. Say, "I love you." Jonathan and David did that for one another. They expressed that love numerous occasions. They pledged or coveted their love for one another. Jonathan said, "I love you as I love myself." Now, I must admit that, again, often we men, and sometimes women as well, are uncomfortable when someone outside of family says, "I love you," and even uncomfortable when someone inside family says it. I can recall members of my own family who never, to my knowledge, said, "I love you." That just wasn't their training and upbringing to do that. And so they were stuck with that rut and never chose to get out of it their whole life. But here we see how important the verbal expression is for friendship. "I love you." I've kidded around a little bit. I think I've done this before with the congregation, but I've said that I get nervous when someone comes to me and says to me, "Pastor," or they say to me, "George, I love you in Jesus." I can never recall having a good experience with a person that said that, although it's possible that I did and forgot. But it's just like it's like that statement of saying, "I'm having a difficult time loving you, and Jesus is making me, so here I am, you know." just don't love me in Jesus, I say to people. Just love me, you know. I had all kinds of people after the first two service days saying, "I love you in Jesus." "I love you." There's a modern Jonathan David friendship told in the TV movie of several years ago called Brian's Song. Maybe some of you saw it. It was the story of Gale Sayers and Brian Piccolo, both running backs for the Chicago Bears. They began rooming together in 1967 and became the first interracial roommates in pro football. Brian Piccolo was an Italian-American who had never been around black Americans. And Gail Sayers was a black American who had never had a close relationship with a Caucasian. They became close friends, and they roomed together for 3 years until in the 1969 football season, Brian Piccolo was cut down by cancer. He fought to play out the season, but he wound up spending more time in hospitals than he did on the playing field. And Gail Sayers, this great black running back, would often fly whenever he could to see his friend Brian. Both Brian and Gail Sayers had planned with their wives to be at the same table, to sit together at the Professional Football Writers' annual dinner where the George C. Halas Award was given to the most courageous football player in pro football that particular year. Gail Sayers was to receive the award in 1969. Piccolo wanted to be there, but instead of being able to be at the dinner, his cancer had confined him to his bed at home. When Gail Sayers stood to receive the award, tears were running from his eyes, and he was noted as the kind of person who did not say too much publicly. But as he took this trophy, he said, and I quote, "You flatter me by giving me this award, but I tell you here and now that I accept it for Brian Piccolo. Brian Piccolo is the man of courage who should receive the George S. Halas Award. I love Brian Piccolo, and I'd like you to love him too." Unabashed expression, "I love you." How difficult it often is for a person to verbalize those three essential words that are so critical in friendship. I love you. The fifth building block is to learn the gestures of love. Symbolic acts which show love. For example, Jonathan gave things like his robe, his tunic, his sword, his belt, his bow. When you are really a friend to someone, whether they're in your bloodline or whether they're non-bloodline friends, you're reaching out in special ways and you attach meaning to your gifts. They're symbolic. You generally, for your deepest friends, do not grab their gifts in a hasty shopping moment at Pick and Save. Not to say that you can't find something wonderfully symbolic at Pick and Save, you understand? But generally, those last-minute kinds of gifts are the friendliness kind of gifts, where we're sort of quid pro quo. Somebody's going to give us a gift, we've got to give them one. But for those who have real deep meaning in our life, we take time. We make something, we create something, or we think of something they would especially want, and we go about it with great delight, and we watch with anticipation as they take our gift. We invest our friendships with symbolic meanings. A marriage counselor asked a husband whose marriage had gone bad after 18 years, "How did you know it was over?" And he responded, "When she stopped putting toothpaste on my brush in the morning." He went on to say, "When we were first married, whoever got up first would roll toothpaste on the other's brush and leave it lying on the sink. Somewhere along the line, we stopped doing that for each other, and our marriage went downhill after that." If you stop putting toothpaste on the brush, you better get that set straight tomorrow. What is being said here? Again, investing acts with symbolic meaning beyond the value of the act itself. What Robert Browning calls the nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Essential for friendship. Sixth building block of friendship, allow the other person space in your relationship. That maybe is very much like point one, but there's a subtle distinction. We have chosen in a friendship to still leave a person free to make their own choices of preference. Now, there are two kinds of choices we make in life. Choices that are clearly right and wrong choices, in which case, as a friend or as a blood relative, we may have a need to try to encourage or help the other person come to themselves. But even then, we can't make that right-wrong choice for them. But there are a lot of other areas that are preference choices. That if we're going to have a true friendship, we have to leave our friend free to choose their own preferences without our imposing our own preferences or will upon them. Classic example of this is the last sentence of chapter 20 of 1 Samuel, where it says, "Then David left and Jonathan went back to town." That was Jonathan's choice of preference. It was not right or wrong. Whether he went back to Saul, his dad, or whether he went off into exile with David, was not a right and wrong choice. It was a choice of preference. And David could have said to Jonathan, if you're going to be a friend to me, then you're going to go with me. I know my friends by the people that hang with me. You go back to your dad, you've gotten in the enemy's camp, and you can forget it. But he gave his friend space and allowed him to make his own choices of preference. That's so critical in friendships, because friendships are destroyed when we don't do that. A friendship does need honesty. We need the freedom to tell another person where we're coming from. But that honesty cannot be encapsulated within a negative attitude. So we must be cautious with criticism in a friendship. And the spirit with which we give correction or advice. D.L. Moody was asked why he didn't criticize his fellow ministers. And he said, "Right now I'm having so much trouble with D.L. Moody that I don't have time to find fault with the other fellow." This matter of space is important within family relationships, as we all know, parent-child relationships. On the one hand, as parents of younger children, we've got to keep a firm grip on things because we want to give our children roots, but we also want to give our children wings. And to give them wings, I think, is more difficult sometimes than to give them roots, because wings lets them fly free. It breeds in them a kind of an interdependence or an independence. And it's not always easy to keep those two in balance. And we, as parents, on the one hand, struggle with whether we're going to be authoritarian, or on the other hand, whether we're going to be laissez-faire and just let anything go. And somehow the truth is in the balance between those two, of having authority yet being relaxed and easy. But parents are always invading the space of their children in choices of preference, are going to sabotage the chance to make a friend out of that child as that child grows. Let me use this little illustration I ran across to show you how I think this happens. There was a psychological study done of a second grade classroom. The teacher had complained that the children were getting harder and harder to control. It seemed like they were always getting out of their seat and roaming around the room. So the school principal sent in two psychologists to spend several days at the back of the room with stopwatches, carefully observing the behavior of both the children and the teacher. Every 10 seconds, the psychologists recorded on their notepads how many children were out of their seat in that 10-second period. And also, they recorded how often the teacher in that 20-minute period said, "Sit down." They were able to observe that in any given 20-minute period, those 30 to 35 children were out of their seat 360 times. That's about each child getting out of his seat every 2 minutes, on an average. I think that's how that works. So the psychologist went to the teacher and said, "We'd like for you to do things a little bit differently. Consciously increase the number of times you say, 'Sit down.'" So the teacher did. In the next few days, she yelled, "Sit down," much more frequently. In fact, an average of 27 and a half times every 20 minutes rather than 7 times. Or about once every 50 seconds. "Sit down." Did that change the children's behavior? Sure it did. They were out of their seats 540 times per period. An increase of 50%. Finally, the researchers asked her to refrain from yelling "sit down" and instead quietly compliment the children for staying in their seats doing their work. The result, the roaming decreased by 33%, the best results in the course of the experiment. What is being said here? If you keep harping on something in a friendship, harping on another person's choices of preference, you are going to sabotage that friendship, and instead of changing the behavior, it's actually going to become more extreme from what you want. Space must be allowed. The Catholic theologian Teilhard de Chardin said, "Someday, after we have mastered the winds and the waves, the tides and gravity, we will harness for God the energies of love, and then for the second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire." Seventh building block of true friendship is that true friendship deepens our walk with God. David and Jonathan's conversations, whenever you run across them, there's always a reference to the Lord. He is incorporated as part of their life pilgrimage and perspective. And the very last mention we have of their meeting, oh, what a poignant mention it is. It's found in 1 Samuel 23:16. David has been for a long time fleeing from Saul in the Judean hills. He's twice turned down opportunities to kill him. And he is on the ropes once more. Jonathan seeks him out. And what's Jonathan do when he comes? "And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God." Oh, that's a powerful scripture. A friend helped him find strength in God. That's what a good friendship ought to do for us. By the way, when Jonathan was killed, you'll notice, maybe you haven't seen it before, but notice that David sinks into catastrophic sin, not during Jonathan's lifetime, but after Jonathan's lifetime. And I wonder if the reason why he didn't stray so far and so bad was because he no longer had his friend to strengthen him in God. Well, how do we tie this all together and apply it to our life? Can I encourage you, within your blood relationships, in your family, and among your friends, to be a real friend? How do you be a real friend? These are the building blocks. Your friend's companionship is more important to you than controlling or competing with them. Two, your commitment to them is real and ongoing. It keeps being renewed. Third, you are cultivating transparency and vulnerability. You're willing to open your life to that person. Fourth, you verbalize your love. You say, "I love you." Find many ways to say it, but it comes down to that. Five, your friendship is marked by loving deeds. You're finding symbolic ways to say to another person, "I love you." Six, you allow your friend some space. And seven, you're seeing that friendship draw the other person closer to the Lord. Now, on the other hand, put the hat on the other head and say, do you have a friend that's doing this for you? If you've got a friend that's doing that for you, you've got a real friend. Treasure that friendship. Friendships, when you get my age, you begin to realize friendships are the most wonderful thing you have in life. Whether the friendship is within family or includes persons outside the bloodline, it is the most wonderful possession you have. Now, one last thing. Look at your relationship with God. Jesus says, "I no longer call you servants, I call you friends." Is he our friend using these seven building blocks of relationships? Well, he is. His friendship is more important to him than competing with us or controlling us. Of course, he's Lord. He does control us. But he says, "I don't want you serving me in a master-slave relationship. I want you as my friend." Companionship is important to him. Two, his commitment to us is real and ongoing. When do we most know if we've got a friend? When we're down, when we failed, when we're discouraged, when we've transgressed. That's when we need a friend. Does he come along and renew his covenant of love to us in those times? Yes, he does. He says to us, "I am with you always. I will never," and I'd multiply that, "never, never, never leave you." He renews his friendship to us in times we don't deserve it and are unworthy of it. Third, does Jesus cultivate transparency and vulnerability with us? Of course he does. I've used Gethsemane as an example of the Lord's transparency. Fourth, does he verbalize his love? Yes, he does. "I call you my friends." Greater love, no love has a man that's greater than this, that will lay down his life not only for his friends but for his enemies. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Thus is his friendship marked by loving deeds or by gestures of love. Well, of course. He went to the cross for us. He took a towel and washed feet. He invests his friendship with loving deeds. Does he allow us some space? Of course, freedom is very important to him. He's not going to make us make any decision we don't want to make. He'll let us be free to make it, not break our arm to do it. And especially if choice is a preference, he will say, "Whom the Son of Man sets free is free indeed." Becoming a follower of Jesus doesn't mean you become a robot or an automaton. That's what a cult does for you. A cult produces the same kind of mentality, the same sort of a darkened look in the eye and the slumped shoulders and the everybody doing it in rote and all wearing the same clothes and doing the same routine and the same ritual. Jesus sets you free from being the cookie stamp of everybody else. He gives you space. Space is essential for freedom. And Jesus, does he help you grow spiritually? Well, in regard to Jesus, that question is stupid. Of course. He has come to grow us into the stature and wisdom that he himself has. He, Proverbs 18:24, is the friend who sticks closer than a brother. Well, the model for our human friendship today has been the model of Jonathan and David. Wonderful friends. But Jesus opens up one deepened area of friendship that goes beyond even that of Jonathan and David, who loved each other as they loved themselves. Jesus gives us a new standard in John where he says, "A new commandment I give to you, not that you love one another as you love yourself, but that you love each other as I have loved you." Apply the building blocks of friendship and then add the icing on the cake, as I have loved you. And you will be a friend. And you will have friends. And you'll be a friend to God. And you'll know God's friendship to you. Our Lord, as we come to you in this moment of prayer, I realize that there may be friends within this congregation today who do not know you personally and have maybe a very inadequate understanding of you, see you as the remote man upstairs or the God who is far away or the God who sits in judgment. You are the God of all creation and the Lord of the universe, but you have also shown us in Jesus that you choose to be friends with us and that you desire fellowship with us. You say to us, "I stand at your heart's door and knock." And then you say, if you come in, you're not going to get us down on our hands and knees scrubbing the floor and just waiting on you all day. But I will come in and eat with you, commune with you, have companionship with you. So Lord, in our lives, help us to make our relationship with you not some difficult thing, but to let it be exactly what you purpose for it to be. You gave your life in order to draw us out of enmity with you, out of ignorance of you, into relationship with you, into friendship with you, into being members of your family. And we want to do that, Lord. If there's anyone here today who has not done that, who has not acknowledged you as their Lord and their friend, I pray today that for them this will happen. Come from wherever they are and come here and share with a brother and sister at the front their desire to receive you as their Lord and friend. And then, Lord, I pray for families who are having difficult times with friendship within their relationships. Pray that you'll help us to go over these building blocks of friendship and not wait for the other person to do them, but to set them in practice ourselves. Bring friendship within families, Lord. We pray, through works of healing and reconciliation so that friendship can take place. And then among us as the body of Christ, make us true friends to one another, not strangers passing one another on Sunday mornings, but help us within the richness of the body of Christ to find those deep and powerful human relationships which help us find strength in God. We ask this in your name. Amen.